Support for KNKX and Sound Effect comes from WSECU, reminding listeners that WSECU is a local community credit union. WSECU welcomes everyone in the state of Washington who embraces the values of giving, sharing, and supporting local communities. More information can be found at WSECU.org.
Hey, it's time to wake up. Not too many of us begin our day earlier than 88.5 Morning Edition host Kirsten Kendrick.
All right, my alarm has gone off. I'm awake. It is dark outside. My family is still asleep. It's time to get up. Get ready for work.
You're listening to Sound Effect on KNKX. I'm Jennifer Wing. When Kirsten's alarm goes off, it's the middle of the night.
I'm going to be really quiet as I get out of my bedroom and into the other room of the house where I have my clothes to get dressed without being too loud. It's kind of hard on an old creaky floor. We'll see how we can do. And so the day begins. And I'm off.
For Kirsten and Morning Edition producer Ariel Van Cleve.
Morning.
Good morning.
Got your papers.
Thank you so much.
Preparing the news for listeners at this hour, 5 days a week, 260 or so times a year, is less about a paycheck and more of a calling. It's a sense of duty.
Good morning.
Today on Sound Effect, the theme is Call of Duty. Just ahead, we'll hear stories about people who have a strong sense of responsibility to do something, and they follow through. Stick around.
It's 5:04. Good morning. I'm Kirsten Kendrick with 88.5 News on KNKX.
So what happens when the thing you're called to do goes against everything you believe in? What if a life hangs in the balance? This is the situation Frank Thompson found himself in while working for the prison system in Oregon. Frank is not from the Northwest. He grew up in Arkansas at the height of the civil rights movement. He lived just blocks away from the Little Rock Nine, who helped integrate Little Rock Central High School. When Frank was a student at the University of Arkansas, he worked to integrate that institution. These experiences shaped Frank to his very core.
The murder of Emmett Till and the murder of civil rights workers were very vivid in my mind and in my psyche. And the communities that I associated with or lived in roundly felt that these were such heinous crimes that decent citizens are being killed because of their pursuit of life, liberty, and happiness in this country, and they're being killed, and that the perpetrators, that if they were convicted and got capital punishment, it would be a just sanction.
Even as Frank's activism work took a back seat to a career in law enforcement, he continued to accept the death penalty as a fair policy.
I had a cousin who was abducted and killed with his own service weapon. And I can remember very well when the guy that killed my cousin was later executed for another crime, I can remember feeling that a sense of justice had been rendered in his demise.
Then Frank went from working in law enforcement to working in corrections. In 1994, he became superintendent of the Oregon State Penitentiary. When Frank was interviewing for the job,
they asked me pointedly whether or not I could conduct an execution. They asked me that specifically, and without hesitation, I told them I could.
When you took that job, there had not been an execution in 32 years.
In 32 years.
When did that change?
It's within the first year. There was an inmate who volunteered his execution. He did not want to exhaust his appeal rights. And with that being done, it sped up the process, and I was notified that I needed to prepare to conduct the first execution.
What was that like when you were first notified by the governor's office? What went through your mind when you received that message or that phone call?
there was just so many things that had to be done in order to take the first step. I need to explain this to you. At the time I got that notice, the Department of Corrections had changed its administrative regulations where executions were to be conducted by lethal injection. The previous form of executions were by gas, but the protocols for doing it by lethal injections had not been structured. So when I got this notice, I had to pull together or become a part of a team who not only had to plan ultimately to take a person's life, we had to write all of the protocols to establish a procedure. If I had taken that job and the protocols were already in place and Oregon had conducted one or two executions with them the past 2 or 3 years, I probably would have walked in, opened the manual, pulled the team, sat down, done our planning, and probably would have gone through 2, 3, 4, 5 executions without really giving that much of a thought. That's the kind of soldier I am or was. But when I got the notice, I was just overwhelmed with the huge responsibility of how to take the first step.
So to give people an understanding of the level of detail you had to zero in on, what were some of the steps, small and large, that you had to be explicit about?
Oh, boy. Well, any execution involves broadly establishing a good public relations program. Then you have to be sure that your institution where the execution is taking place, it has to be prepared for any demonstration on the parts of the inmate populations. Another team I had to have was responsible for building the execution room. Then you have your tie-down team. That's the team that escorts him from the room into the room where the gurney is. You have emergency medical technicians who insert the IVs. And that's just a few. All of that had to be orchestrated in concert for the final act of executing someone.
At some point in this process, did your views on capital punishment change?
It did. I felt a heavy, heavy sense of responsibility, and it caused me to do some real deep thinking about what I was really involved in. And all of the flaws that I was aware of with the death penalty, they just sort of started coming to me very clearly.
Do you remember the first flaw?
Well, in the back of my mind, I knew that death row throughout the country was heavily populated with minorities and poor people and mentally ill. And I knew that there was a likelihood that innocent people were being executed. I also was aware how difficult going through executions were on staff people. I realized that taking the life of this person who was scheduled to die would not make the community any safer. And I consider myself to be a very dedicated public administrator. I don't believe that any public policy should continue to be promoted if over time you determine that it is not accomplishing what it is supposed to accomplish. And here I was training men and women how to go in and take the life of a human being in the name of a public policy that couldn't be shown to work. And I was practically, as a public administrator, offended, and morally, it just reached in very deeply, and I had to come to grips with where I really stood.
And did you have staff members who came to you with questions and concerns?
There were some that said they had problems sleeping. That was an instance where one decided that he didn't want to be involved anymore, and another quietly went on for other employment.
And what did you tell them? Because you were obviously dealing with your own doubts about this whole process.
Well, when I realized that I didn't support the death penalty, I did have conversations with them, letting them know that every stable society needs to have professionals he can do the difficult jobs, and that we are being called upon to do a difficult job.
You stayed on the job, and you carried out that first execution, and then you carried out a second. But if you had those profound feelings that led you to falling down on the side of being against capital punishment, why didn't you leave?
Well, you have to understand that conducting an execution is not even 1/1000th of what I do as a correctional professional. At the same time, I had fingerprints going on some programs that are saving lives, and I had a team of people who were putting together programs that will help keep inmates involved, get them ready for being introduced back into the community, and ultimately cut down on recidivism and eventually keep them from coming back into prison and possibly being on death row. So many times in life, you have to weigh the good against the bad. And I imagine if the execution at that point in time overshadowed everything else I was doing as a correctional professional, I might have contemplated that. Soldiers who are in a war that don't agree with, they don't take their uniforms off and bail. They serve with honor and dignity. I think there's another side to that question. How can the community continue sending men and women like myself and expect them to do this kind of a thing over and over in the name of a public policy that can't be shown to work, and then turn around and ask me, how could I do that? It's just not me. It is the entire community that votes for policies like that. And there are casualties. There are the people who've been murdered in the first place that put the person on death row. And there are the men and women who have to carry this out, who suffer PTSD. And there has to be a voice somewhere that steps out and say, whoa, folks, this is not working right. And I'm glad to be able to have a voice to try and challenge people to take another look at what we are doing.
All right. Well, Frank Thompson, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you a lot.
Frank Thompson retired from corrections in 2010. The following year, the governor at the time, John Kitzhaber, he announced a moratorium on executions in Oregon. It's still in effect. Today, Frank Thompson is a member of Oregonians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty. This is Sound Effect on 88.5 KNKX. I'm Jennifer Wing. Our theme today is Call of Duty. In our darkest moments, when things are looking really bad, sometimes something unexpected happens that can give a person a little bit of hope and comfort. For Jessica Sklar, this came in the form of a woman who is called to help people by sharing an unusual skill that she has. This person entered Jessica's life when Jessica was in an incredibly fragile state. Jessica is a math professor at Pacific Lutheran University. In September 2012, when she was 38 years old, she woke up one morning and something was not right.
My eyesight was very compromised. Basically, what was happening was my eye muscles were becoming paralyzed.
Jessica called a relative to let them know what was going on.
When I spoke on the phone, I realized my speech was impaired. And at that point, I thought, oh my gosh, I've had a stroke.
Jessica called 911 and went to the hospital. She was in an MRI machine getting tested to see if she did in fact have a stroke when she started to have trouble breathing. At first, the technicians chalked it up to anxiety. Lots of people get scared in these machines. But just to be safe, they brought in the necessary equipment to insert a breathing tube if things got really bad.
And at that point, my breathing just stopped completely. My lungs became sort of paralyzed, but I was able to breathe out, and I said, I can't breathe. Do it now. And then they sedated me, intubated me, and I woke up paralyzed.
It took 9 days for doctors to zero in on what was causing this paralysis. After various tests, it was determined that Jessica was frozen because she had been poisoned by botulism. She ate something bad.
I believe it's the most toxic substance known. So a very tiny amount can really do you in.
Her recovery was going to take months. She moved into a long-term care facility. The nerves hit by the toxin had to regrow. She couldn't breathe on her own. To make breathing more comfortable, doctors took the tube out of Jessica's mouth and gave her a tracheostomy, a hole cut into the base of her neck where a tube went in and a ventilator filled her lungs with air. Her arms and legs were paralyzed. She had no voice. The only part of her body she could move were a few toes on her left foot.
I would either nod with them or shake with them as if they were my head. And also my friends and family would help me spell. So they would sort of break down the alphabet. They'd say, if they knew I wanted to say something, say, okay, A through M, and I would say yes or no. And we would narrow it down to a letter and do that one at a time.
She insisted on tapping out complete sentences.
It was a very slow process. I would sometimes fall asleep while spelling.
After weeks in this state, Jessica was able to move her lips. Staff noticed this and introduced her to Consuelo Gonzalez.
I think when I came in, and she was sort of like, oh, who are you? Another person. And I introduced myself and I said what I did.
Consuelo is a professional lip reader. She can understand what people are saying by the shape their lips make.
And she said something like, oh my God, finally, or something, you know. I can't remember exactly, but she was just astounded and relieved to finally be able to communicate.
It was just like the heavens opened up. Suddenly I could have a conversation with someone after all of this time.
I know from personal experience what it is to have a challenge communicating, because while I can speak for myself, I can't hear for myself.
Consuelo lost her hearing when she was a child. No one could figure out why. It started to fade when she was 4 years old, and by the time she was 8, she was profoundly deaf. She learned how to read lips both on her own and by watching her mother, who was also deaf.
I know intuitively how frustrating and sometimes isolating it can be for the patients if they can't communicate. Now, they're on the other side. They can hear everything that's going on, but they can't communicate. And I can't hear anything that's going on, but I can communicate. So you put us together and it makes it work.
For a few hours each week, Jessica gave her toes a rest and was able to have long conversations with Consuelo.
By this point, I believe I developed a reputation for being really obstinate in the hospital.
Through Consuelo, Jessica asked the doctors and nurses questions about her care she had long wanted answers to. Jessica also talked to Consuelo about the vivid dreams she was confusing with reality.
One of the interesting things was in her hallucination, she was arguing with a nurse, and they were having a back and forth conversation, and I said, well, Jessica, I don't think that could have happened because you don't have a voice. And she just stopped and went,
oh.
And she sort of looked around and she sort of chuckled and she goes, you mean maybe all of that was just a hallucination? I said, I think it probably was.
I told Consuelo we were dead. I told her we were in Texas. I told her I didn't have any legs.
It was the drugs. And usually I would be able to jump in and say, well, let's think about that. And she'd be able to figure it out that that wasn't what was happening. Sometimes these are the conversations you have to have when someone's not all there, but at least they're understood, they're validated, and they can let go and continue with their healing process.
Because Jessica was on so many different medications, she'd forget what the staff had told her, even about aspects of her care that were repeated multiple times. There was one thing that terrified her, something she could not make any sense of. She says staff would come in, wake her up, and cut her off from her oxygen, and then they'd ask her to take a deep breath.
And it would be like, I don't understand. There's no oxygen to breathe. How can I breathe when you're not, when you've disconnected my breathing apparatus? But you can't say any of that. You can't ask any of that. You're just woken up and your oxygen is removed.
The medical team wasn't trying to kill Jessica. This was a routine test to see if she was ready to be weaned off of the ventilator.
With Consuelo, was I could say, I don't understand this. What is this? Why is this happening? How am I supposed to breathe when there's no oxygen? And she was able to, you know, communicate to the medical staff. She's not trying to be difficult. And that was just one of, I think, many things where it's like, I don't know what's happening. Please have them explain it.
There are other ways for Consuelo to earn a living reading lips, but she says explaining to a vulnerable person what's happening to them in a hospital and helping them separate horrible dreams from reality is the most rewarding way to use her unique skill.
You know, there's people who are always trying to figure out what's that celebrity on YouTube saying, you know, and they want to go, could you watch this video? Tell us what that celebrity's saying. And I will, you know, if they hire me, but that is not very interesting to me. But what's really wonderful is being able to use the skill to create healing and to create communication between human beings. That's what feels good. That's what's the best. Love, you know.
After 4.5 months in the hospital, Jessica was eventually taken off the ventilator. Being bound to a bed for so long made her incredibly weak. She could touch her smartphone screen, but she didn't have the strength to press it hard enough to send a text message or to make a call. She had to learn how to walk again, how to eat, how to talk. A small scar above her clavicle is a reminder of what she went through. Jessica eventually went back to work as a math professor. After her experience, she wrote a new living will. One thing she added is that if she ever becomes incapacitated like this again, she is never to be left alone. For this next story, we head to Soap Lake in eastern Washington to a 180-acre ranch owned by the McMillan family. They run a feedlot. It's a place where cows put on weight before becoming steak dinners. And they supply rodeos with horses that are bred to buck and bulls that cowboys have a hard time staying on for more than 8 seconds. And again, today on Sound Effect, we're exploring the call of duty and what that means. And for Mark and Lynette McMillan, their sense of duty lies with their family. The McMillans have 10 children. 6 of them are adopted. Josie joined the McMillans when she was a baby. Now she's 9. And on the day that we meet, she's sitting on top of her black and white paint pony named Rebels. And he has one eye and gets around just fine.
He's a good pony. Because he listens sometimes. Sometimes.
What are you going to show us?
I'm going to show you spin the horn, just going around the horn. And I might do 2 more tricks because I can. I know how to do the backwards 1-foot stand and thread the needle, the secret trick.
Now, folks, from the little town.
For the last 7 years, the McMillan children have been performing at rodeos all over the western United States doing trick riding. On galloping horses, these kids ride backwards. They stand tall in the saddle, arms spread wide, resembling the figurehead of an old wooden ship. They hang off the side of their beloved pets, holding on with just their feet hooked into a special saddle, their bodies parallel to the ground.
It's all about they trust their horse, and so what seems scary to you and I, they got it.
That's Lynette McMillan, Josie's mom, and the mom to Riley, Hannah, Zane, Landon, Josh, Caleb, Big Josh, Nick, and Davey.
Sometimes the horse will be going like super fast, and I'm like going, oh my gosh.
Do you ever look away?
Sometimes I squint my eyes, and so I can just barely see them. For some reason, that keeps them safe. I don't know why, but it does.
Mark and Lynette, they never set out to have a large family, but they got an idea of what it would be like by watching their close friends, Shelley and Jay, take in foster kids.
So Mark and I would go visit, and we would see Jay take these kids with him. They would work, they called it the sheep station, and they'd have to ride their horses like, 10 miles in the freezing cold and, gather cows and stuff. And they loved what they did, and they loved Jay, and they loved the hard work. And you could just see that it was good for these kids. It was just, they were thriving in this situation. And so Mark's like, let's get licensed for foster care. And the day we got licensed, they called us with a little boy, Nicholas. And he was 4 years old. And I couldn't even take him shopping because he would run from my car and just run out into traffic and stuff because he had been neglected. And my husband even said, Lynette, I don't know if we can keep him safe. And so I was going into a meeting at CPS, with all the social workers and stuff, and I was going to tell them that we just couldn't do it. And I got there, and I'm pretty sure it was the Holy Spirit putting the, chain on my lips, and I could not say the words that, and I said, we'll take him.
The youngest McMillan is Landon. He arrived when he was just 2 years old. The other foster family he was with was overwhelmed.
And they told us, they said he cusses and he's disrespectful to women. And I'm thinking to myself, how could a two-year-old, but he was. And it was amazing some of the stuff that would come out of his mouth and stuff at two and a half, but still, it was amazing. And we had an eyeful and an earful. And but he's gotten better over the years as that fresh air and that exercise and stuff. He was a lot easier to deal with. And so that's kind of where we have ended so far.
What was your childhood like where that maybe seeded this?
My mom and dad were givers, and they would take anyone in. And I remember my brother's friends coming over and living with us for a little while. You know what I mean? And so I learned from example. I mean, they would give you the shirt off of their back.
Taking these children into your lives and bringing them into the fold of your family, what was the risk that you and Mark talked about?
When the kiddos, especially when you bring these older kids in, what they have been exposed to, I mean, we just, something that we probably, will never in my life, experience. And these kiddos, since they were little, have like lived this. And, they know a lot more than my kids. You know what I mean? My kids are pretty naive to, the drugs and the sexual stuff and just everything. You know what I mean? There is a lot of, that goes on in these homes that I don't even know about. You know what I mean? And then they bring that to your kids. But on the other side, my kids, they would take in, if another kid showed up at our door right now and they said, hey, he needs a home, my kids would be the first ones begging me, let's take another one, let's bring them into our home. And so my kids are giving, and I'm not saying that they don't ever say, what did you adopt him for in the bad moments and stuff, but you go to school and they stick up for each other till the end. If we can give these kids the foundation that they need, then they can go out and then they're going to have families that'll mirror ours. And that's what I'm hoping, because a lot of them come from broken homes and they never see, the full circle of what a family can be.
Trick riding. How did that get started?
My mom was a trick rider in New York, upstate New York. Her mom and dad owned a dude ranch, and her dad wanted her to learn how to trick ride so that she could perform for the guests. And so she trick rode when she was younger. She had all these pictures and stuff, and I always, would look at those pictures and want to be a trick rider, but she was afraid. She's like, oh, no, because too dangerous. And so in the back of my mind, at the rodeos, I would see trick riders, and it always intrigued me, and I liked it.
Two of the McMillan girls wanted to try it out, so Lynette sent them to a trick riding camp in Colorado.
And they came home, and we got on our horses here at home, and the kids, it just took off. It really did. And then they taught the other kids. And so before you knew it, we were traveling all over the United States. It's just really weird how it just fell into place.
So far, the only injury the McMillan kids have suffered by doing trick riding is a broken foot. One of the boys lost his balance and had to quickly jump off the back of his horse. Lynette and her husband say they are not going to take in any more kids, but they do hope to someday make their ranch a place where other foster parents can come with their children and bond by working outside together in the fresh air. It's a formula that so far has worked really well for the McMillans. Lynette wants to be a mentor to other adults and children who are trying hard to become families. To see photos of the McMillan kids in action, go to our website, knkx.org. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Sound Effect on KNKX 88.5 FM. I'm Jennifer Wing, and today we're telling stories of the call of duty. And oftentimes, that sense of responsibility is to a place, a specific community. For writer Jack Cameron, the place is Tacoma. He just loves his hometown.
There's not a lot of pompousness about Tacoma. No one's going around saying that Tacoma's the greatest city in the state. We seem a little more real. Like, Seattle has a certain image. Tacoma almost doesn't care about image, and I think that's what I like about it.
Jack expresses his love for Tacoma through a website he created. It's called TacomaStories.com, and here you'll find interviews with local characters, park reviews, and other community news. But there's one section on the website that is oddly beautiful and incredibly sad. Jack writes a post for every homicide victim in the city. He tells each unique story.
I almost never even mention the perpetrators' names. It's basically about who the victim was, what happened. It's a way of putting it online where people can see what happened to these people, and sometimes it's the only record of what happened to them.
Jack felt called to start documenting Tacoma's homicides back in 2006.
I was talking to a friend who was from Seattle and had this view of Tacoma that Tacoma rightly earned in the early 90s of being crime-filled and being very dangerous. And at the time, things were much better than they used to be. And I told him, you know what? I bet I could write about every single homicide that happens in this city, and I wouldn't be too busy. And it ended up being a little more than one homicide a month.
Yeah, so you started this out almost as a challenge.
Yeah. There was this part of me that was afraid that maybe I was totally wrong and maybe I'd be very busy. Like, if I'd tried that in Chicago, it wouldn't work out.
One of the most interesting things about Tacoma homicides are the comments that people leave and how people find this information. Ryan Wilkerson was the victim of Tacoma's fifth homicide this year, and he was shot in what authorities say was a targeted shooting. And the page received 20 comments from friends and families remembering him. And a friend, Tara, wrote that it was such a senseless and unnecessary tragedy, all a result of that dark world of drugs. And it's made me despise that lifestyle more now than ever. And you were so much smarter and so much better than the life that you were allowing yourself. I pray that the person or persons responsible for this are brought to justice, and I will love you for the rest of my life until we meet again. What goes through your mind when you read some of these comments and remembrances?
Honestly, it's my favorite part of doing this. The comments are what make it worthwhile. It's why I can't stop doing it. By and large, they're people I don't know. And so all I can write is what I can find online, whether it's their Facebook profile page or stuff written about them in the press. But I didn't spend any time with them. And so the comment section, I specifically have, I moderate every comment, and I make sure that it's a comment about the victim, usually from friend or family, and that it's positive.
So in a way, the person who died is fleshed out through the comments, and you get to know them better through these remembrances.
That's the idea. The difficulty is that you have some victims who just don't leave much of a digital footprint.
And in one post, you wrote, Jeffrey Wayne Shaw is the 13th Tacoma homicide this year. He was not unknown to the police. A quick online search will show he has a lengthy criminal history. It might not show that he has an 11-year-old son or that he was apprenticing to be an electrician. It will only show the friends and family who are devastated by the loss of this man. It won't show what it's like to grow up without a father. You chose a lot of personal information. You added a lot of information to this. Why did you do that?
Because it's easy to forget the criminals. A lot of times people will say that if somebody gets killed during a drug deal, well, they were dealing drugs. What do they expect? Or somehow that dealing drugs is deserving of people being murdered on the street. And I just don't feel that's true. I think that every human life has value, even if they did bad things.
How are you emotionally compelled to do this work?
It seems like the least I can do. It's something that I'm familiar with the police department. I'm familiar with the media. And there are people right now in the city who are going to be killed. And when they are, I think somebody needs to speak for them beyond just the criminal investigation. I think somebody needs to at least put up a signpost saying this person was here. That's one of the reasons it's called Tacoma Stories, because everybody's got a story, and this might be the last chapter of their story, but it's not the only chapter.
Some would say that you're presenting an unflattering view of a city you appear to love. What's your response to that?
Well, that's one of the reasons why that's not the only thing on Tacoma Stories right now. I started a thing called Five Question Friday, where I will talk with local business people or people that you know around Tacoma, like Sonic's guy or whatever, and point out the good things that are going on in Tacoma. I was kind of bothered when it was just the homicides, because literally someone had to be murdered for me to update my website, and that seemed a bit much.
And do you ever think that you'll stop documenting homicides in Tacoma?
I don't know. I thought that I would if I moved away, but then I moved to Pacific for a few years and I was still doing it. So clearly that's not happening. I live back in Tacoma now, and I don't see myself moving in the near future. So if I ever stopped, I would have to find somebody else to continue it, because I think it's something that's necessary, especially with present-day media. Most websites like the News Tribune and whatnot, after 90 days or so, most of their articles aren't available, or they're available only behind a paywall. And so I've gotten dozens of emails from people who say the only thing they can find about what happened to their friend or relative is on my website, because it's nowhere else. So I feel like it's something that's necessary, and no one else is doing it.
All right. Well, Jack Cameron, the writer and founder of the website Tacoma Stories, thank you so much for talking to us here on Sound Effect.
Thank you.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Sound Effect. I'm Jennifer Wing, and we continue today's theme, A Call of Duty. And of course, here in America, that phrase is most associated with our men and women in uniform. To sign up for the military is to feel a very strong call to duty, a sense of loyalty to your country. But what about when that loyalty is questioned? That was the case for many Japanese Americans during World War II. Still, a lot of these young men, American-born but with Japanese parents, felt the need to defend their country. There are only a few surviving Japanese American World War II vets in the Northwest, and I went to meet with one of them.
I'm Fred Akira Shiosaki.
How old are you?
Oh, I'm 19, going on 29.
Okay.
No, I'm 92 this year.
92.
At 92, Fred uses a cane to get around, but honestly, he seemed to just strut into the room for our interview, and his sense of humor is as sharp as any 19-year-old's. Fred's parents immigrated from Japan at the turn of the last century and ran a small laundry business in Spokane. As Fred thought back to his youth out in Spokane, he remembered the day when everything changed for his family.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy.
I was a senior in high school, preparing for finals for the seniors, you know. So there was study every afternoon, every evening about that time, listening to the music on the radio. And of course, these news breaks come on, somebody is bombing Pearl Harbor, and of course, in the, it was the Japs are doing this. And they, you could see the big red circle on the plane. And I went down and said, "Hey, Pop, guess who just bombed Pearl Harbor?" And she said, "Well, I don't know." I said, "Well, the Japanese did." He said, "Oh, kondo wa donna baka nakoto shite." What kind of crazy thing is going on now? I just remember, I don't know much Japanese, but I remember that. My dad was a small businessman. Well, he was the only Japanese family around there. He depended on his neighbors to do their shirts and their work clothes and all that kind of stuff. And all of a sudden, Saturday, Monday, nobody came in. And he figured, well, we're going to starve to death. But they discovered pretty in a couple of weeks that nobody wanted to do their dirty work clothes, and nobody would iron their shirts like my dad did. So business picked up.
When the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, our west coast became a potential combat zone. Living in that zone were more than 100,000 persons of Japanese ancestry, two-thirds of them American citizens, one-third aliens. We knew that some among them were potentially dangerous. Most were loyal. But no one knew what would happen among this concentrated population if Japanese forces should try to invade our shores. Military authorities therefore determined that all of them, citizens and aliens alike, would have to move.
Some of the Japanese Americans were allowed to leave the West Coast defense area. There were very few Japanese in Spokane at the time, and that population doubled and tripled. It was a real problem. And then, if you didn't know, they put you in an American concentration camp. That was the all-American way. It was one of the grossest, I don't know what they were, anyway, it was goddamn criminal thing. Then they announced that they were taking volunteers to go in the military intelligence service. What they really needed are guys who could read, write, and speak Japanese, and they needed them in the Pacific. They really needed them badly. Well, of course, I went down there, and they started reading Japanese. They said, "What did I say?" I said, "Damn fine, oh." And it was sometime later they announced formation was all Japanese-American combat team, and I signed up for that.
The Americanism of the great majority of America's Japanese finds its highest expression in the thousands who are in the United States Army. Almost half of them are in a Japanese-American combat team created by order of the Secretary of War early in 1943. They know what they're fighting against, and they know what they're fighting for.
Why did you feel that you had to do something? What was going through your mind then?
Well, you know, I had black hair and brown eyes, but I'm an American, isn't that right? What else were we?
So you saw the U.S. putting Japanese Americans in concentration camps.
Yeah.
How did that make you want to fight for this country that was treating friends and family?
You never think of it that way. That, by God, they're not going to do that to me because I'm going to volunteer and see if I can do something. I lived in an almost all-white neighborhood. There were Italians and Germans, and they were all the second generation like we were. But it turned out, see, that me and my brothers were all enemy aliens. So those kids disappeared. And I'm sure they wondered, what the hell, how come a friend doesn't go? And I looked for some way to get in the service. I knew I had to do something. The reality is that my oldest brother, they sent him back to Japan to go to college. Because if he had enough money, that was a sign. Well, once the war started, the Japanese closed down their universities and drafted all those young guys. And there was my brother, George. And he was an American citizen. They couldn't touch him. But he was Japanese ancestry. And the American embassy could not help him. So there he was stuck over there. Finally, they just starved him out. They said, well, you're not a Japanese, so we're going to take away your rations. So he finally had no choice but to denounce his American citizenship. So when he did that, they drafted him into the Japanese military. Shortly thereafter, he got sick, you know, nerve disorder, all this kind of stuff. He spent the balance of the war in a Japanese hospital, trying to nurse him back to health. So he really served the Japanese army by by just being that sick. Over those years, we never heard from him. We tried through the International Red Cross in Switzerland to see if they could locate him, but Japan would not cooperate.
The National Broadcasting Company delays the start of all its programs to bring you a special bulletin. It was announced in San Francisco half an hour ago by a high American official not identified as saying that Germany has surrendered unconditionally to the Allies. No strings attached.
The Japanese have accepted our terms fully. That is the word we have just received from the White House in Washington, and I didn't expect to hear.
You heard it, ladies and gentlemen, and we're here in the Time Star newsroom with a traveling microphone. The war is over. The Japanese have surrendered.
What was your life like? How were you treated when you returned?
I want you to know that you're looking at a real... I don't look like it, but I was really belligerent. And I get in more fights. Of course, I had a couple of drinks, of course. And I more than once, you know, the cops would come by and tell my dad, hey, your son's got to straighten him out. And they never did put me into jail, but I used to get in the street squalls with other guys who had been in the service. And they said, well, you're a Jap, and we used to kill guys like you. And I said, you look a German, and I used to kill guys. On and on, you know, until we drank enough beer and got out behind the building and struggled a little bit. It was a time when it was easy and not easy, okay? I'll put it that way. The real problem was my oldest brother.
How did your family finally find him in 1950?
Yeah. He was finally working as a interpreter for a newspaper and all this. He was doing all right, but think he let us know, but he didn't. I'm really still pissed about that. People on the West Coast never could understand why they let those Japanese people own property and run farms and stuff like that. It was just makes you mad every time I think about that. Our contribution was our lives. We said, okay, we'll sacrifice our lives, but you got to let my mother and father become American citizens and own property and all that. But nevertheless, they eventually it worked out.
That was Fred Shiasaki, a Japanese-American World War II veteran. He fought in Italy and France and with the Army's 442nd Regimental Combat Team. Fred won a Bronze Star and a Purple Heart for his service. After the war, he became a chemist and worked for the Spokane City Health Department. In 1952, his parents, Kisaburo and Tori Shiasaki, became American citizens. We had our conversation at Fred's home, Aegis Living on Madison in Seattle. That's it for the show this week. Sound Effect comes to you from producers Kevin Kniestad and Allie Ferguson. A special thanks to KMUZ Public Radio in Salem, Oregon. We get web help from Dave Nagaris. Aaron Hennessy is our executive producer. You can find Sound Effect on the NPR One app, and you can also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. And if you'd like to share a story, you can send us an email to soundeffect@knkx.org. We'll be back next week when our theme is underwater.
Something to do, I guess, go out and wrestle an octopus. So since we have the largest octopus in the world in shallow water, we decided, well, it might be a nice event to try and run and do.
I'm Jennifer Wing, and this is 88.5 KNKX.